This goal of life is the ultimate oneness of existence. You will find this idea described in all different religions. It is, therefore, also we can see this in our all other activities, that we are really seeking oneness. When we seek happiness from various objects, what we are really seeking is becoming one with it. When we get the feel of that oneness, we get the sense of happiness. When we try to know something, knowledge is one of our main urges. What is meant by knowing really? If we analyze that, we again, there too, are trying to discover the one that explains everything, the one that binds everything, one that weaves everything together. That gets called knowledge. As Swami Vivekananda has given this beautiful illustration, that what is the Newton's law of gravitation? That so many things they are happening, a law explains all these multiple events together. In that one law, or the falling of an apple from the tree, as well as how the different celestial bodies they are held together, all that is contained in that one law. So it is one that binds many events and many things together. So our search of knowledge is also actually the search of oneness. When we reach the ultimate oneness, the knowledge that we get, that also will be ultimate. There is no further to go. Ultimate knowledge. And also, for example, another thing that we seek in life is love. That we feel that we should love and we should be loved. What is this love again? This love is oneness, feeling of oneness. I and you are one. Your existence is my existence. Your desires become my desires. Your pleasures become my pleasures, your pains become my pains. So that is the idea of love, a feeling of oneness. So this oneness is really our goal. And so when we are approaching to this oneness is actually our true nature. It is not to be just discovered outside, but removing the fictitious boundaries between I and the world. These boundaries are really fictitious because we cannot fix them. Fix in the sense you cannot demarcate the exact line that separates you and the world. Try, friends, and you will find that it is an impossible task. And try to draw a line where I end and the world begins. And you will give it up as a hopeless task. Why you cannot draw such a line is because there is no such line really. It is only a figment of imagination that we feel I and the world. It is out of ignorance that we have this division, I and world. And yet, all our actions, all our life is somehow or other based on taking for granted this division. We take for granted this division for our life of ignorance. And yet in and through that, there is this call of unity. the multiplicity binds. I end here, the world begins there. So a limitation is drawn, so to say, around me, a fictitious limitation, and I get bound. Although I am really infinite, I get bound in this cage, as it were. So, here we see this a tussle between our true nature and what we ignorantly assume to be what we are. This has to be bridged. This gap between the truth and our perception has to be bridged. And this is done in many different ways. One of the ways, or the most important for all of us, is to train our actions to make it instrumental in taking us to this goal. We many times see our working life as an obstacle to our religious or spiritual life. We hear people saying this all the time, that I do want to practice worship, spiritual discipline. I like meditation so much, but where is the time? From morning till night, my life is bound with so many works. You are okay, Swami. Your Swamis don't have much work, so for you it is all right. But look at us, we busy people always have to do lot of work. So how can we concentrate on our ideal? How can we practice that religious disciplines? The solution is given here, that you don't have to give up your actions. You have to, in fact, keep on continue with your actions. Do your duties, whatever you need to do, do it by all means, with all sincerity. Put in all your efforts. What is to be done is to change their direction in such a way that now, instead of being a binding force in life, they will become liberating force in life. It is that example I have given here many times. Let us remember it again. Once we had a water pump that used to draw water from the well. And one morning when we started it to pull up water, the motor started, pump seemed to be running, and no water was coming up. So we were puzzled what happened. Then we called a mechanic, he fixed it in 2 minutes. And I asked, well, what was wrong? No, the connection, the positive, negative, that got changed. And therefore, the motor was running, but in reverse direction. So the water was not being pumped up. The motor was running, electricity was getting spent, but no actual work was getting done, because it was running in the wrong direction. So, in our life also, the action is taking place. And what is happening in our action, by our actions? We are getting more and more bound, more and more attached, and more slavish. They work, instead of becoming an instrument of freedom, it is becoming instrument of bondage. And what needs to be done is change the polarity, and the same motor works. It starts pumping up the water now. It is nothing more has to be done. Just change the direction of it. If you are driving in the wrong direction, and what you need to do, you don't have to buy another car. Just change the direction and you start going in the where you need to go. So, this has to be done with our works too. Our works then become our worship. There will be no conflict between work and worship if work is performed in the right manner. That is important. Just calling, my work is worship, I don't need to do another worship, that won't work. Actually, you have to bring about that change. The change in the attitude has to be brought about. Then only that happens. It is not just matter of saying by mouth that yes, my work, that day Swami was telling that work should be done as worship. And so I don't need to do any other worship, my work is my worship. But just by saying that doesn't make it. Actually, one has to change the direction. And that was what we were seeing in the 30th verse of the 3rd chapter last time, that this work is to be done with the idea of dedication to God. Our, what we call normally as worship, like say offering flower or offering some incense or some food items to the Lord. If you see, it is an action, and yet why that action becomes worship? Because of the attitude. Because of the attitude of dedicating it to God, that action becomes worship. So what is important, what makes a particular action as worship is the attitude. So put that attitude in every activity that we are doing. Now this is a task. Why this is a big task is because we are habituated to do work in a different manner. We have been habituated. It sounds rather harsh to our ears, but let us face the harsh realities that we are habituated to work like slaves, not like free people. We may have so-called political freedom, but that doesn't make us really free. What binds us really are our tendencies and habits, and those things put a tremendous bondage on us. That is why, see how our attitude is. When somebody feels, I am working for the bank, somebody who feels that I am, say, working for McDonald's, somebody feels I am working for a school, are you working for yourself? You should be working for yourself. When you are working for somebody else like that, then, naturally you feel alienated, as Karl Marx puts it. You feel alienated from your work. And thus you become a slave. And that idea of Karl Marx, although Karl Marx is not very popular in US, some of his philosophies are great, worth studying. His analysis is very nice. Doesn't matter whether you are socialist or capitalist, it is worth studying. He says that the worker, no matter how much money the worker is getting, the monetary remuneration may be more or less, the worker has that feeling that I am working for somebody else. And thus the work gets alienated from the worker. And this alienation is like you become a slave, that you are under somebody. Somebody is getting the benefit of what you are doing. You don't feel that kind of benefit It is like a drudgery, the work goes on. Oh yes, 8 hours I spent in the factory. Ah, now I am tired. Now I need some relaxation. So, for 5 days a week, people work waiting for the relaxation. 2 days of Saturday, weekend relaxation. And what do they do on those weekends? Again, they work. They go out for something and get into traffic and call names to the traffic. What all these people are doing at this time? It is what you are doing, the same thing they are also doing. So, it is, and you come back again, a tired person, at the end, Sunday night or someday, you come back after a so-called relaxing outing, and same routine starts again. This is a slavery. But the work has to become our own liberating instrument. It has that capability. We have to discover that capability, that the work should be for us. We are doing work for us. It is, one lady was telling me, very nice, in a dentist office, and she said that, you know, I tell myself every morning that I am going to gym, not for work, but I am going to gym. So I feel relaxed. I am going to gym without being, without having to pay. To go to other gyms, you have to become member, you then have to pay some monthly fees or whatever. But I am going to a gym where the gym pays me for going there. So I get that good feeling, and also because that was of course a joke, but it was nice. Because I feel I am going to gym, I can allow myself a luxury of another piece of pie, because I was having a workout. So, it is. So the work should be basically for us, whatever work we do. That should be, if it is done for worship, as worship, then it becomes a force in our life that liberates, that takes us to God or our goal. Whatever name you want to give, if the word God doesn't appeal, think of that as the goal of life. So, it is to the goal of life. This work can take us, provided it is done with that idea of dedication to God. It has become now worship. Its nature has changed. It is now the poison has been taken out of it, and a life-giving nectar has been filled in it. So now that work is very good for us. That work becomes spiritual practice. The conflict between the work and the spiritual practice is thus taken away. So he says that 30th verse, Mayi sarvani karmani sanyasya adhyatma chetasa. That adhyatma chetasa, that surrender all your activities to God and know. Adhyatma Chetasa is a very beautiful word that it is translated here as with your mind resting on self. Many different translations can be given, but the idea is more or less same in all, that feel that you are not this collection of bones and blood and all that, you know. It is, are we this skin sack filled with some flesh and some blood and some stool and urine and all that stuff? Are we that? If I keep that kind of a sack here, you will say, hey, take it away. Don't put it here. But that we call as I, and try to beautify it, oh, so nice. Are we that? Let us stop identifying ourselves with this matter. We are spirit, and we are the consciousness within. I am that. See, the body keeps on changing. I, unchanging. And this training one has to give to oneself, that learn to separate that which changes from that which does not change. We feel these two things with us. Everybody feels the changing aspect and the unchanging aspect. In Vedanta, that is called the discrimination between the changing and unchanging, which leads to discrimination between what is real and what is unreal. That which changes is unreal. That which does not change is real. That is how we decide, you know, what goes away is unreal. Like dream, you saw something in dream. But when the dream was over, you know that it didn't last. Somebody might have given you $1,000,000 in dream. You cannot go and claim that from that person. Hey, I saw you giving me $1,000,000. Give me. Somebody might have promised you. You might have been dreaming that you have won a jackpot in dream. Well, in the waking state you cannot claim it. It is gone. So because it is gone, it is not real. Similarly, if you analyze our waking state too, you will see that it is not real beyond its waking state limits. In the dream, this waking state becomes unreal. For example, you might have gone to bed after having a sumptuous supper, full, and you went to bed, slept. In dream, you may feel very hungry, you know. Although you had big supper, it is no guarantee that in dream you won't feel hungry. You may feel hungry in dream, because the supper of the waking state doesn't work in dream. So you eat a lot in the dream, but still when you wake up you still need breakfast. Because that breakfast, that lot of food that you took in dream doesn't work in the waking state. So our experiences in waking state are not confirmed by our experience in dream state. And similarly, our experience in dream state is not confirmed by our experience in waking state. So, if we look at it from the point of view of its status as real, both are equally unreal. Both of them, the waking state is as unreal as the dream state. It appears or it sounds to many as a frightening statement. It is not frightening, friends. It is illuminating statement that our experiences in waking state too are true only so far as waking state goes. As that philosopher of his name Chuang Tzu, he was a Taoist and a very good teacher. So he said, once I had a dream that I have become a butterfly and jumping from flower to flower. Then I woke up after a while and I thought that I am not butterfly, I am a human being. But then a thought came to me, what is real? I thought that I am thinking now that I am a man and I dreamt as if I am a butterfly. But it may be true that I am really a butterfly and I am having a dream that I am a human being. Who is to decide what is real? There is no independent authority to judge there, that whether you are a butterfly or a human being. Nobody can judge that. So, both of these are equally unreal, because both of them shift, both of them change. What did not change in both these is that you were the same. The I that experiences dream also experiences the waking state. The body changes. The dream body is not same as the waking state body. It can be butterfly. It can be anything as such, you know, and can do many things that you cannot do in the waking state. The logic of waking state is different again from the logic of dream state. What appears to be incorrigible in waking state appears to be perfectly rational in dream state. In waking state, if you are told that, well, go to moon right now in a second, in the waking state it is impossible. You will say that what a fool you are. You cannot go to moon in 1 second. But in dream you can go not only to moon, to the farthest galaxy you can go in a split second. Because the logic there is different. If you study the basis of that logic, it is again very interesting study of mathematics, that how our waking state logic functions and how our those imperfections of our logic, it being based on a discrete number system in waking state, it has its very stringent limitations. In the dream state, our logic is not based on this discrete number system, and therefore its scope becomes much widened. So it is a very different logic that is at work at dream state. So what is being pointed out here is that whether you are awake, whether you are dreaming, or whether you are fast asleep, in all these three states, what did not change was that awareness of I. That I remained the same I who is awake was also having dream and was also having deep sleep. It is, you know for sure that who was having the waking state experience, the same being was experiencing the dream too. The dream world also was being experienced by the same being. Just as you do not have any experience in the waking state where you are not there. In every experience of waking state you are there. Similarly, you don't see a single dream Triveni where you are not there. You have to be there in your dream. Have you seen any dream? Try to remember. Have you seen any dream where you were not there? You cannot see such a dream. You are always there in your dream. That awareness of I is unchanged in all these states. These states keep on changing, but I remain the same in all these. So remember, that is our ID, real ID. What is ID? That which does not change every now and then. If you go to airport and they ask your ID before you can board the plane, on your photograph you may be have put on one dress and you change the go to there in a different dress, yet they identify you. Because your dress is not your ID. Dress can change, but your face and other things do not change that frequently. Then they know now that the face also can be changed. You can have plastic surgery and have a long nose. Not that you should do that, but it is. One can change the shape. Many criminals have done like that to elude. So they have now fingerprinting. The fingerprints, they don't change easily. It is impossible, almost impossible to find two sets of fingerprints exactly alike. Then there is that DNA. So you say that that is the ID. But that also is only ID as far as the body is concerned. You are more than that. So what is our real ID? What really does not change? That is our real ID. And let us remember, I am that. The great Vedanta teacher Shankaracharya has written a very beautiful, very sublime hymn. It is titled as the Six Stanzas on Nirvana, Nirvana Shatkam. It begins, Mano Buddhya Hankar Chittani Naham Nacha Shrotra Jivhe Nacha Ghrana Netre Nacha Vyoma Bhumi Natejo Navayo Chidananda Rupa Shivoham Shivoham. I am not mind or intellect or the memory. I am not the various sense organs and motor organs. I am not the eyes, ears and so forth. I am not a collection of bones and blood and flesh. I am the existence absolute. Why it is existence absolute? That never becomes non-existent. I am that existence absolute, knowledge absolute and bliss absolute. Chidananda Rupa Shivoham Shivoham. So let us feel that. That is the idea that Adhyatma Chetasa, fixing our mind on the self. And then another important aspect of life, the spiritual practice comes, which is commonly called Raj Yoga. Or the yoga of concentration and control. And we have to learn to work without this being nirashi nirmamo bhutva. Know that nothing is mine. And don't expect anything. Our expectations become cause of misery and bondage. We expect many things from the world around, and when those expectations are believed, then we feel terrible pain. We do not know actually that what right do we have to expect. We keep on expecting, yes, I will get this from this, that from that, that from somebody. No, don't expect anything. Our expectations become the cause of our bondage. Do your work. Do whatever you are doing for others with concentration, with love. Do that. But don't expect anything in return. That is a great discipline and a great vehicle for happiness. Expect and you get bound. Expect and you are sending an invitation for misery. Any expectation, that means that you are asking for misery. You have no right to expect behavior of other people or other things, let us say, to generalize, is governed by so many factors. And we feel that that person must do like this. What right do we have? That person is governed by so many things. Are you the governor of the behavior of that person? You cannot govern even your behavior, but you want to impose that person must do like this. Can we govern our behavior? We cannot. We are propelled here and there by various impulses in our life. So, we should not expect anything from anybody in the world. That will save us, you know, lot of problems. Lot of problems will get saved if we stop expecting. Do your things, the results will come to you. We don't have to keep on expecting. A question gets asked about it, that if we don't expect, how shall we work? For example, if I tell Chris that I have this school, you are the teacher at school, you come to work at this school, you teach there, don't expect any remuneration. He is not going to come to work. Are you? You will say, no, why should I go? So, if we say that we should work without expectation, what will make us work? Why should we work? Why? It is the expectations that make us work. If we don't expect anything, that what will make us work will become just inert. Not so, friends. What we get is not according to what we expect, but what we work. Take the same example. If Chris expects that I should be given $1 million for my work every month, just because of his expectation, are they going to give you $1 million? No, your expectation doesn't bring the result. Your work brings the result. Not your expectation. Your expectation only brings bondage and misery to you, nothing more than that. But we somehow confuse, feel that because of my expectation I am getting, by my expectation I am getting only bondage, nothing more than that. And therefore, this is important to learn to work without expectations. Work. Let us work with full dedication. In fact, we will be working with much more efficiency if our expectations do not hinder our attention. Many times it happens with students more, with others also, but students, when they are studying for this thing, they start immediately, instead of concentrating on studying, they start feeling, I am now studying this, then after this I will get so much nice grade, and because then I will get him getting such nice grade, then I will get such a wonderful job offer, and then I will do this and I will do that, and they study remains on one side, study doesn't go on. So the students feels, I have been studying for 12 hours. Were you studying for 12 hours? Just think. Maybe 12 hours you may be sitting in front of the book. That may be possible. You may not have studied more than 12 minutes. And the mind was just roaming about, generating many expectations. Another trouble with this expectation is that they go on multiplying, you know. If you have just one expectation, that is done, no. One expectation gives rise to two more expectations. It is an exponential function, you know. So soon it becomes so many expectations that you don't know how all these expectations are going to be fulfilled. Therefore, this is a training that one has to acquire. Work and do whatever is to be done, whatever you feel right, do it without expecting. And there is a nice story, and take just the moral of it, that there was a scorpion. Once there was a lecture given by our Swami Atmajnanananda here about that scorpion and the saint. The scorpion and the saint. And there was a saint, and he saw a scorpion in the water stream getting drowned. Now, because of his compassionate nature, he took the scorpion and put it out. The scorpion stung him, and again this scorpion fell in the water. Because he could not get the opportunity to pull it out completely, and got stung. Again this saint tried to pull it up, because it's the saint saw that the scorpion is getting drowned. So he again pulled the scorpion out. Again the scorpion stung. And scorpion stung, I don't know whether anybody of you have an experience of what a scorpion stung is. I have, I know. No, it is certainly not an enviable experience. So, it is terribly agonizing pain, you see. It is. And this saint did it once, twice. An onlooker was watching it. He came to him and said, "Hey, don't you know that it is the nature of the scorpions to sting? Why are you again and again trying to bring that scorpion out? It is its nature, it will sting." The saint said, "Well, this is my nature to take it out. I am acting as per my nature. It is acting as per its nature. It is my nature to feel compassion and help. But that doesn't mean that I expect that the scorpion also should become saintly and not sting me." It is like that. The expectation creates a lot of bondage for us. So, let us work with whatever we know as right, that right activity should be done without any expectation, and without, this is again a difficult part, without the feeling that something is mine, that possessiveness is another bondage. We are truly speaking, and we possess everything. In fact, we are everything. But we choose something and say, "This is mine," which is wrong, which is untrue. As a limited human being, you do not possess anything at all. This problem comes to us because of this idea that this is mine. This is mine, and thus we, because of that claim, and we have this, that this is my child, my son, my daughter, my friend, my wife, my husband, my. We try to lay claim, try to lay ownership, and this my really has no local standing. How that thing becomes yours? There is actually nothing belongs to you. It is a very common feeling that parents feel that the children belong to them. And that becomes therefore a big source of suffering for them. It is that actually no child ever belongs to that mother or father. They didn't really know how it happened. And they do. How do they claim that this is my child? There is nothing that should let them do that. But somehow this feeling generates, it is mine. And that perpetuates. We start then expecting that my child. Sometimes we cover it up, you know, that no, I don't expect anything from my son or my daughter for myself. But I want them to be good, to be nice, to be well settled, to be so and so. That is, again, you are expecting that from them. Do you feel the same about somebody else? It is you consider them to be yours. They are not yours. Nothing in the world is mine. And that is the secret to know that everything is yours. Everything is yours. If you give up everything, then everything becomes yours. There is this nice two definitions. Definition of a human being and definition of God. Very beautiful definitions. What is a human being? A human being is a circle with its circumference is infinite, but its center is located in body at one point. That is a human being. Circle, infinite, that this is mine, this is mine, this is mine, infinitely vast circle, but center is located in one body. God is also a circle with infinite circumference, center everywhere. That is the difference. It is not center at one point, but center everywhere. That is God. So, it is, this idea is to be cultivated. Nothing belongs to me. This is matter of practice. Through work, we can do that. This nothing belongs to me. And fight. Here it is the question of the battle. Our whole life is kind of a battle. That yes, we have to battle with so many wrong tendencies in us, with the forces of circumstances, and we have to progress means there is an opposition, you know. And thus, through that opposition, we have to win our way. That is the battle of life. Swami Vivekananda gave a very beautiful definition of what life is. He says, life is that which tries to manifest against all the forces that try to push it down. So, against all this we have to keep on battling in life. So, how should this battle be taken up? Without fever. It is said that Yudhyasva Vigata Jvara. Vigata Jvara means without any fever. What is fever here? That you become very excited, kind of possessed, and do it. We see people doing work like that. And sometimes we feel that is how great works are done. Not great works are done like that. Great works are done with calm serenity. It is only lot of noise you will see lot of noise, very little output. It is not that a lot of noise and lot of humdrum makes big work. It is really, it is the characteristic of low efficiency. It is low efficiency. You see the car, and think of an old some car and not properly oiled or anything, not lubricated, makes lot of noise. Means what? There is lot of friction. Things are striking each other unnecessarily. Too much energy is lost. So, lot of our energy gets lost in emotional effervescence. That one needs to control. The more control, the more will be the efficiency in work. The more serenity, the more will be the output in work. It is not that excited emotions do lot of work. Excited emotions do lot of damage. Excited emotions are very different from a calm, serene, focused personality. You don't see that person ruffled by anything. That person does tremendous work. And Lord Krishna is the greatest example that I can think of such work. You see the work that he is doing. No rest in the battlefield there. He is the charioteer. And after the battle is finished, he is taking the horses, just cleaning them, taking care of all their wounds and all that. And for whole night he is again getting ready for making them ready for the next day's battle. He has no rest at all. He is working continuously. Then there are, he is Lord, so many of devotees are coming for him to advise. He is talking to them, consoling them, advising them. That is going on. And all this with tremendous serenity. And never ruffled. Manifestation of tremendous strength, tremendous activity, and perfect calmness. That is Lord Krishna. Tremendous action is going on, and yet a perfect calmness is there. A manifestation of strength is not that, you know, you see the horses all just running about, gone amok, and well, that is one kind of strength. It is, it doesn't do anything. Look at that strength, which puts them, all those horses are brought under control. Now those horses, they can, that strength can be put to actual work. Lot of things get accomplished. So, our turbulent senses and our turbulent mind, when it is brought under control, we see that tremendous work can be done by that. Our the psychologists tell that of our psychic energy, hardly 1% gets utilized. Hardly 1%. Imagine, you know, if we can put 100% of our psychic energy into actual work, how much great progress we can make. So, that requires a real serenity and calmness and control. So, all these things need to be attained. And this attainment is to be done not just one method for everybody, not just one discipline for everybody. This is not a military regimentation. The people differ. Every person is different in constitution. So, these things are to be handled according to each individual constitution. We will see that in the next verse, how the handling of this personality and directing that person towards the right goal is to be done. We will have to wait till next Friday. The time is already finished. Well, if you have a quick question, we can take it up. Oh, Richard, okay.
All Swamis teach non-attachment, but the culture teaches bondage. The human family is a self-replicating proponent of bondage.
Well, it is...
You're outnumbered.
Huh?
You're outnumbered.
Well, that doesn't make any difference, you know, whether outnumbered or not numbered. Actually, you cannot say that world teaches this and the Swamis teach this. It is the question of what you want to learn. You get teachers, you select your teacher, you know. If you want to learn attachment, you go to learn attachment to those teachers who teach attachment. You go to the world. Exactly, you will find those teachers who will teach attachment. And those who want to, if you want to learn detachment, you go to the teacher. That is why you came here. You could have gone to an opera show, you could have gone to a restaurant, you could have gone to many other places. So you choose your teachers, you know.
But you don't choose your family and you don't choose your culture. And they train you really, really well.
That also you take it, you know. That is not that they don't teach you. It is we who learn, you know. Take the first very important lesson that Vedanta wants to give is own the responsibility. Instead of blaming others means now you don't own any responsibility. It is not that they teach you, it is something that you want to learn, you go to them. It is the culture, family and all those things. Let them give you all those things. You will take only that which suits you. Other things you don't take. You plant a seed in the soil, and the seed doesn't take everything that is there in the soil. Whatever it requires, it exactly takes that and grows according to its capabilities. You put the seed in a soil, it takes that. You put this stone in the soil, it won't grow in the tree. Because the stone is not taking anything from the soil, the seed is taking something and growing. So it is we choose, that is that freedom you have, that is the important thing, that we have the idea of freedom. I have a choice whether to take this or whether to take that. At every moment we have this choice. Foolishly, we blame on others that they are responsible for that. If they are responsible for that, then you have no hope of redemption. Because it is they who have to do you. You have nothing in your hand. But fortunately, you have a choice. You have this freedom in you. That is this great saving factor. And so you choose the right teachers. It is in our Brown University, so many branches of learning are there, and different professors are there, and they arrange that shopping also every session, and that you can go and experiment and choose which teacher you want to go with. People according to their likings, their tendencies, they choose. You cannot say that, well, because it is like that. All different world is full of teachers. It depends on what we want to learn. If we do not want to learn, nobody can teach us. If we want to learn, then that great statement of Shakespeare, that the books become the books for you. You find sermons in stones. So everything becomes teacher if we become student. So one has to learn to become a student. And what the student of we become, that thing comes to us. And the world teaches us ample detachment if we want to learn it. Then the world teaches that to us. But we don't learn it, that is our problem. The culture, society, family, if we want to learn, it teaches us ample amount of detachment. But we refuse to learn, that is my problem, you know, not the problem of the culture or family. It is. So, we can learn lot of detachment even from world, even if you don't meet a single Swami. And don't think I am completely detached. I am also trying to learn, you know. And not that the Swami is just by putting on some different clothes and giving, I am only on this side of the microphone, you are on that side of the microphone. That is the difference. Not much of difference between us. So, it is we all have to learn. That's all.